for coming. My name is Marilyn, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Love and Service Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Will you please help me open this meeting with a moment of silence to do it as you wish? Thank you. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we are glad you are all here, especially newcomers. In keeping with our singleness of purpose, we ask that all who share confine their discussion to alcoholism. If you are unsure if you are an alcoholic, we have literature in the other room on the back table that can help you decide. If you wish to join this group, please see Melissa, who's standing at the moment, and is our current membership chair, after the meeting. Our business meeting is held in this room on the first Saturday of the month at 5:30, and everyone is welcome. The Love and Service Group encourages sponsorship. We have found through our experience that helping other alcoholics with the 12 steps is vital to our own continued sobriety. If you currently do not have a sponsor, this group encourages you to read this pamphlet, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship. We also ask that anyone available to sponsor another alcoholic, please raise your hand at this time. Keep it up a minute, a second. If you need a sponsor, look around and maybe choose somebody after the meeting. Okay, we have several readings, and I'm going to ask the people I've asked to read to come to the microphone. We have the first reading, What is AA? And I think Melissa, this is coming up.
Hi, my name is Melissa, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strengths, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you, Melissa. And someone has the 12 steps.
Yes. My name's Pat, I'm an alcoholic. These are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Pat. And Scott is going to read our 12 traditions.
Hi, everyone. I'm Scott. I'm an alcoholic. These are the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group will never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, less problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of trust, reading, and film. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Scott. And Lauren is going to read our concept of the month.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lauren, alcoholic. From the 12 concepts of world service. Number 5, throughout our structure, a traditional right of appeal ought to prevail, so that minority opinion will be heard and personal grievances receive careful consideration.
Thank you, Lauren. When we pass the basket, all contributions we receive go to support a single purpose, which includes contributions to this church for use of this room, our general service office, our Central New York AA, our District 800 intergroup, as well as literature and supplies for this meeting. We ask that you only give if you can, and that only AA members contribute, as we are fully self-supporting through our own contributions. If you smoke, please dispose of cigarette butts properly using the cigarette disposal receptacle provided in the parking lot. And please make sure right now, all of you, to silence your cell phones. And we have a bulletin with service-related AA announcements that we encourage you to check out after the meeting. It's on our literature and pamphlet desk out in the table out in the other room. And can we have our literature grapevine report, please? Do we have a literature report? Okay. Can we have literature for sale at cost, and pamphlets and grapevines are free for the taking out on that table. If you'd like to purchase literature, please see our literature rep after the meeting, and that person is... Okay. Thank you. Do we have an intergroup committee of the month report? No. Okay.
I am Alex, I'm a bot. Well, the intergroup committee of the month, I'll just talk about the intergroup as a whole. So our intergroup has two things, right? There's a central office, it's a clearinghouse for literature, as well as an answering service. Our intergroup takes it very seriously, the fact that we have an alcoholic who answers the phone 24/7, 365. When all office is closed, it'll roll over to members of Alcoholics Anonymous in our community to make sure an alcoholic talks to an alcoholic. So this is one of the functions of the central office, as well as it houses an intergroup, which is made up of a bunch of different committees. So public information, cooperation, professional community, corrections, treatment, accessibility. And I can go on for a good amount of time, but they really serve out and serve the purpose of helping the alcoholic who still suffers in a variety of different ways. Many people come to Alcoholics Anonymous through whether calling a phone number, through the phone book, going on the website, there's a website committee, going on the website and finding a meeting, or being in treatment and having a group bring a meeting to them in treatment, or being in jail, having a group bring a meeting to them in jail. It's an incredibly important service to help the alcoholic who still suffers, but also the people that serve it. I know serving Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life. So if you're interested in participating in that, please let me know, let any of the members here know. We'd be more than happy to get you plugged in and kind of going that way. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. And now, Todd is going to come up here and lead us in a sobriety countdown.
Hello, everybody. My name is Todd. I'm a colleague. Here at the Local Service Group, we like to recognize
miss some of the great moments in AA, and that is obviously our sobriety. That's what we come here for. So if anybody would like, or if everybody would like to stand, we're just going to go ahead and count down backwards. We're just kind of a tall order of feet. That's not the best five or seven. Right, so what's going to happen is the person going to be presented a big book from our guest speaker who came in from Toronto to share with us. So if everybody wants to go ahead and get started, so let's get involved. Thank you.
Blossomed, and they were able to then share the load. It took a few months for more members to join. The group let the area know that they started the meeting by word of mouth. It was an exciting time for quite a few members and folks around the Rochester area. People were excited to come be part of the new energy forming on Witten Avenue. Group members would hang out by the front door to see if any cars were pulling in the driveway. They had their box of Joe and 6 to 8 chairs set up in the small front room. One member would yell to the other 3 or 4 people in the room, 2 more cars just pulled in. Within a few short weeks, the group had to go back to the pastor of the church and ask if they could start using the larger room because the small room had run its course. Today, the Love and Service Group meets each Saturday for an hour and a half. Many people ask the reason for this. When the meeting was brand new, the idea was that everyone should be able to share. The meeting ended when the last person spoke. Sometimes this meant the meeting was shorter than an hour. Some nights it was 2 hours long. Eventually, group members decided to make the meeting a set 90 minutes. The group always felt it was important to participate in service outside the group level. A GSR and intergroup rep were 2 of the first positions filled in this manner. Treatment, corrections, and the public information / cooperation with the professional community followed after. Our group still has these positions today, along with alternates for all 5 of those commitments. Most recently, we have created group service positions for the Accessibility Committee and Night Watch Committee. Due to the small size of the church at the first location, the church would on occasion not allow the group to use the facility some Saturday nights. This meant that the meeting was canceled. Over a lot of time and much, much, much discussion, the group came to the conclusion that it is important to never cancel an AA meeting. An ad hoc committee was put together to look for a new location, and we moved to this church in February of 2012. The group has grown in size and membership over its 8 years of life. The membership first consisted of men, and that was for a long time, but has grown to include many females. We currently have about 50 home group members. A big change for the group came when we decided to change our name. Some group members felt that there was a slight affiliation with other AA meetings of similar names. Again, there was a lot of discussion, and it took months to come to a decision. The group eventually agreed to change the name, and then more time went into finding the right name for the group. Love and Service was agreed upon and became our new name in 2013. Though our group has been in existence for 8 years, tonight is the first time we are celebrating our anniversary. We thank you all for coming and celebrating tonight with us. Our new name was inspired by the last talk Dr. Bob gave. Here are the words from that talk. This is from Dr. Bob. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same result in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months and my strength hasn't returned as I would like, so my remarks will be very brief. There are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind and which would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is and we understand what service is, so let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let's also remember the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to do numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get such a degree of smug complacency that we're not willing to extend or attempt to extend our less fortunate brothers that help, which has been so beneficial to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Melissa. And now, I've been looking forward to this, we all have, for weeks and weeks. And it's my great pleasure to introduce to you our anniversary speaker who came all the way from Toronto, where she is a member of the Rocks Glen Traditional Home Group. And it is my pleasure to introduce now Mildred Frank, who also goes by the Evil Nun.
My name but I'm also an alcoholic. Those two things don't seem to go together, do they? Or maybe they do. I'm really glad to be here, and I thank you for the invitation. I am more grateful than you know to have this invitation. I thank you, Shannon, for your friendship and for the invitation to come here. And I'd like to introduce Shirley, who was my driver today and brought me from Toronto. Come on up, Shirley. Say hello. So, I want to tell you something. I've been to many groups over my years of sobriety, and I don't know that I have ever experienced quite the enthusiasm, the friendliness, and the welcome that I have experienced tonight. So my thanks to you. It's quite extraordinary, as was the food. Whoever the man is who made the sausages, I'd like to take you home with me. Best sausage I've ever eaten. I'll go home with that memory. If you won't come with me. So I'm here to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. You know, sometimes we say we're here going to share stories. You don't want to hear all my story. Some of it is illusion, some of it's fantasy. I don't know if some of it happened. I do know that I'm alcoholic. That I do know. And so what I really have to share with you is really the gift of grace that has come into my life. Tomorrow I will be, and I might as well tell you this, tomorrow I will be sober 41 years. Mildred, or the evil nun, whichever you choose to remember me by, that clap is for the grace of God that has done for me the same thing that it has done for you, is doing for you on a 24-hour basis, breath by breath, if you so allow it. In other words, to allow you to live free of the compulsion and obsession, which gives you the platform for growing in the spiritual way, which is the message I have to bring. Because if I think back, when we did the countdown, I had to sit down at 40. Tomorrow, I'll stand for 41. But 40 years ago tonight, 41, I guess it is 41 years ago tonight, I didn't know I was alive. Because I was in a blackout, living on a park bench, homeless and alone. And that was to change very quickly. So that's, you know, when I think, I really love to hear your hope, experience, strength, and hope as well, because it lights the fire in me, because we each have that experience, strength, and hope. It comes in a different body, it comes through a different set of experiences, but it's not about that, it's about the grace that moves in us, and has moved in us, and will continue to move in us as we allow it. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time in 1966, and I'm not sober 49 years or 48 years, so you know something did not take. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Did I need it? Well, let me get this thing started. I had been locked up in psych wards, mental institutions, and insane asylums 32 times. I had had 38 electroshock treatments. I had been tied to the bed, and it wasn't for fun and frolic. I had been in a straitjacket. They used to put me in cold water baths because I'd be so violent they couldn't handle me. I've had hundreds of hours of therapy, all of that, and I even married my very own psychiatrist, which should tell you about the insanity of my state of mind. I spent 15 years in a convent. I was dedicated to trying to find a way to make life work. I just couldn't do it. And so, did I need AA? You can tell me I certainly needed something. Did I want AA? Yes, I did. But I wanted it on my own terms. And whether you're sober a long period of time or whether you're sober a few days, God bless you, this thing doesn't work on my schedule. And it doesn't work on yours either. If I've learned anything, I have learned that. This is truly about, it's a spiritual program, it's a spiritual way of life. So, how did I get so messed up? Well, I was born on a farm in Saskatchewan. Most of you don't know where Saskatchewan is. It's got 12 letters. Look it up. It's between Alberta and Manitoba. And I was born into a family of 10. My parents were good Roman Catholics, as you can see. And we were German, and I liked none of it. And then at 3, I began to cry because I had a sister, and I won't belabor this, but just because I do think we are the product of the things that happened to us in childhood. And don't worry, I'm not going to talk about the inner child, because that's not what I believe in. I believe that we are imprinted. We learn things as little children. You know, I'm 41 years sober tomorrow morning, and I'm still affected to a certain extent on some days by the things I learned. That's the way life works. And, you know, when God, I was always told, Dr. Bob said, keep it simple. He didn't say that. He said, let's not get involved with Freudian complexes and scientific things which have nothing to do with our work. How I was raised and the ideas I took on in childhood do have something to do with how I live today. Actually, in a sense, it's been at the root of who I am. You know, I'd like to tell you I wound up on a park bench because I drank alcohol. You know, Bill says, he doesn't say it's not my problem. He says it's the symptom of my problem. You see, I drank alcohol because it was my solution. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. My sister, in those years, she was 16, I was 3. She crawled to bed with me and she cried. They kept her in grade 3 till she was 16. I don't need to tell you what a crucifixion that was. And she'd cry at night and she'd say, why was I ever born? Why didn't I die in the cradle? And I'd cry with her because I loved her so much. I wanted her to stop crying and then I would stop crying. Went to my family and told them because I'm the baby and they love me and I knew that. And I gave them their marching orders and nothing changed about this thing that disturbed me so much. We were Roman Catholic. We went to church every Sunday. And so I heard that God was love and God was power. And I thought, you know, I'm not stupid. I think let's give our kids credit. Because I think a lot of things go on in those little minds and those little hearts. It certainly did with me. And I said, I've got a solution now. God's going to fix it. And I asked God, and nothing happened. What do you do with that useless twig? If you've got lots of power and lots of love, why don't you fix things if one of your children is crying? I didn't understand. A God who makes beautiful sunsets and makes the starry sky and doesn't fix this. I didn't understand. Oh, my goodness. It's difficult to talk about this stuff because I'm sure that if you get to it, there isn't a person here who at some point hasn't looked and had a problem and wanted to say to God, fix this, and you expected it was going to get fixed according to your plan, like I thought, and it didn't get done, but it did get done. Dora got healed. I got fixed as much as I am fixed to this day, and so I'll get on with this. I didn't turn against God at that point. I just became confused. And then at 5, I took a drink, and everything changed. It was like putting on a new pair of glasses. The lenses I had looked through before said, me, 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 me. I don't like life. Life sucks. I want to get away from this. And those new lenses said, life is wonderful. You're wonderful, honey. Yours wonderful. I can handle it all. It's just lovely. I had that unnatural reaction. I didn't have to drink 10 years to decide that maybe I was an alcoholic. I didn't know that I was an alcoholic, but what I knew was the stuff in that bottle did the job. And that's what I chased for the next 35 years. And that seemed to be the thing that took me to the park bench. That was the thing. I love, I brought my little big book with me, where Bill, talking about the spiritual experience, says, we acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness. I didn't get a God consciousness, I got a good consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. That's what I got. See, that's what I think Alcoholics Anonymous really is. Alcoholics Anonymous now gives me that. If I do the work, and to the degree that I participate and follow what this program is about, that I get from Alcoholics Anonymous, which is, I think, a way to look at your life. If you're struggling, if you're sad, if you're depressed, if you're down, take a look at it. Is there something missing in your spiritual program? Is the spiritual malady still up and running in your life? Anyway, that's what I got from that drink. And that's what I chased. Because my mother never understood this. She used to say to me, as the years went by and I kept doing worse and worse, more obvious things, she used to say to me, you're such a nice girl when you don't drink. What she meant was, we don't have to pluck you out of the ditches. We don't have to come and get you out of jail. We don't have to come and get you in the courtroom and all that kind of stuff. She didn't understand that there were two of me. There was the me that couldn't bear being here, hated this third dimensional experience. And there was the me that absolutely loved it and went insane when I could get that booze into me. That's the story of my alcoholism. I'm not going to get into a big, long drunkalog tale, but what I can tell you is this. Once I put alcohol into this body, I can no more guarantee what I'm going to do. Because as that great man, Dr. Silkworth, I think he really deserves being called one of our co-founders. Because at the time he said this, he was one of the medical field, and the only one that I know of, that had this insight. That he says, we're much like other people when we're sober, but if you put alcohol into us, he said they have an allergy, and it manifests as a craving. And he went on to say, we're restless, irritable, and discontent. And I would add, angry and depressed and God knows what, so unhappy with the way this third dimension operates, until we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort. See, he didn't say experience ease and comfort because he knew it didn't last. It wasn't the real thing. It's the sense I feel good for a little while. And I know that when this thing wears off, I need more of that stuff. That's the story of alcoholism. You see, the story of my life is not about how much I drank. I had an enormous capacity. But that's not the story. The story of my alcoholism is the story of the death of a human being, a crippled human being, crippled by self-centeredness, crippled by defiance of God, and crippled by hatred of the way things are. You can't get along when you are the way I was. You've got to make something go away. And I knew how I could make the pain go away. So that's what I chased. I can tell you, I drank anywhere. I was not fussy. I did not need a crystal glass. I hear people say, I only drank scotch. Well, bully for you. I drank whatever. I can tell you, I have drunk many a bottle of vanilla. One time in the convent, Mother Superior was saying to the house sister, She said, "Sister, did you bake cakes today?" Sister said, "No." She said, "Well, you must have. I smell vanilla." It was me breathing in the corner. That's what she was smelling. And I can tell you, I have stopped many a bottle of perfume. Chanel number 5 goes down very hard. But boy, you smell good. And I didn't care who I drank with. I didn't care if you were a bigger rounder than I was. I didn't care where we drank it. I've had many a bottle that I put down in a washroom and places worse than that. I wanted the effect. And once it went down, I could breathe. Oh, yeah. Isn't that amazing? And the new pair of glasses went on, and they weren't the ones Chuck Chamberlain talked about. They were the glasses that took off the me, and I could see you. See? And everything was different. The only problem was the drinking of the alcohol created, I did things that I wouldn't have done. It was like a two-edged sword. Because when I was sober, I was one kind of person. I have a brother who was an alcoholic. He was two people. When he was sober, he had nothing to say. He sat there somber and quiet. When he was drunk, he was a different kind of person. I was the same. So when I was sober, I was all this stuff was churning inside me. When I was drinking, I felt I could take on the world. And for a lot of years, I functioned. I went to university. I did all kinds of things. I played that big pipe organ. I took singing lessons. I did all kinds of things. Because when I drank, as long as I didn't drink to the point of under the table, I wasn't afraid. I liked you, and you seemed to like me, and it was okay. And so that's the way life went. I felt I never fit. I felt nobody cared about me. And I just never fit. I didn't fit in elementary school. I didn't fit in high school. I'm a klutz at physical activity. So nobody wanted me playing ball and that kind of thing. You wanted me if you were doing intellectual stuff. That's where I shone. I finished high school when I was 14. And I wanted to go off and be a lawyer. And my dad said, absolutely. And I never did that. You know why? Because I was afraid. I learned when I was a little girl, if you've got a problem, nobody helps you. Dora was crying, nobody fixed it. What if I go off to the city? What if I go off to university and I get a problem and I don't know where I am and I don't know what's happening and nobody's going to help me? That'll keep you stuck and that'll send you to a convent. Maybe. It sent me to a convent. I was afraid of life. I wouldn't admit that for years, but that was the truth. I was afraid of life. And I had another idea in the back of my head. I didn't give up on God. I didn't know what that creature was. But I thought, maybe if I do something really hard, then God will be pleased. That will show him that I'm a good person and he's going to fix my life and I'm going to be happy. And so off I went to the convent. Don't go to a convent if you're a drunken nun. Or a drunken person, I should say. I was drunk the night I entered there, and they took me anyway. You know, and if you want to stay drunk, it's complicated, but staying drunk in a convent isn't the worst place you could be, because there's always mass wine, and there's always booze in the place, because people bring, because the sisters are going to have a little sippy poo on Christmas and Easter, and God knows why. And then you always have friends who bring you booze, and lie and cheat and do whatever. Yeah, you're saying, yeah, but don't you have vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience? You really do, but you play around with them. You just, that's a watch it. That's why they call me the evil nun. Or the flying nun, as you choose. Anyway, I was a good nun. In a sense. In a sense. I was a good nun when I was drunk. When I wasn't drunk, well, I was who I was. Anyway, after 15 years, I had a mother superior who was really enlightened, and she called me and she said, Mildred, because I'd been home to my father's funeral drunk, that's not a good thing to do either. When you have the long black habit on and people are watching you and you're the only nun in the place and you're stumbling. So she called me and she said, I don't think you're happy here. So I said, no, I'm not. And she said, you know, you're young enough and you're smart enough and you'll make your way. So we wrote to Rome and I got my dispensation. And on January the 10th, 1966, I stood on the convent steps, leaving to make my way. Though I was a well-educated young woman, nobody would question that. I stood there and I didn't know the first thing about life. I did not know what I know in spades today. The problem is in here. The problem is never you. See? It's always in here. And that's why Bill wrote in the 12 and 12. It's a spiritual axiom that if I'm disturbed, I'm the one that has to change. If I don't like the third dimension, I better take a look at what's going on inside me. I didn't know that. And I thought, I'm okay now. I no longer have the vows. I'm no longer Sister Mary Eugenia. And I'm just going to go out there. And I just knew there was a man out there. What I didn't know was there were many men out there. And I needed to drink. And as I was left, you know, it's not a small thing to take off that identity, the identity that gives you all kinds of privileges, all kinds of, you know, ways of looking at people, and they look at you, and now you're secular. I didn't know how to live in the secular world, but I knew that everything was better with booze, so down to the bars I went. And I found the booze, and I found the men, and the men found me. And I have to tell you, the next 10 months were 10 months of degradation, which I will not go into. I got put in jail several times, and I told the chief of police he couldn't do that because I was an ex-nun. And he said, my suggestion to you, young lady, is that instead of trying to get me to let you out of jail, you get a damn good lawyer. So that's another piece of the story. I had myself put into 999 Queen Street thereafter, which was then Ontario's insane asylum. And it was the snake pit, the equivalent of the snake pit. But I knew there was a psychiatrist there who I thought maybe could help me. I was there 2 weeks and I didn't want to leave. You know, you can become institutionalized in all kinds of ways. And my brother came from Saskatchewan, which is about 2,000 miles away. He came and he found me and he took me back to Saskatchewan. And there my life was to change because he took me to Saskatoon, which I agreed to. I didn't know who was there. My future husband was there and Dr. Hoffer was there. And if you know the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know that Bill had consulted him about LSD. At that time, Abe was doing research. He was using LSD with schizophrenics with some success. And Bill thought it might help alcoholics, and he took it, and so on and so on. And so Dr. Hoffer knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. He went to my psychiatrist. I mean, I had a file this thick. I had been diagnosed with everything and things they hadn't thought of yet, I think. And he said, this girl's alcoholic. She needs to go to AA. And so I went to AA. I was excited because my dad had phoned me at some point about this brother who they said was dying. And he said, there's been a miracle in our family. Your brother isn't going to die. He's not got all those diseases. He's an alcoholic. And he said, a new organization has come to Saskatchewan. He said, I don't know what it is, but it's so good. And he started to cry. He said, they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. And your brother is sober. He's been transformed. He now works. Good sign of transformation. And so my dad was pleased about this. So when Dr. Hofford told my psychiatrist said, you should go to AA. Of course I'll go to AA. I'm going to be transformed. My dad's going to be pleased about this. So to AA I went. Parked my hiney on a chair and thought, now it's going to happen. I don't know who's going to do it, but by God, it's going to be special. 3 weeks went by, and I'm not transformed, and I'm not drinking, and I feel just like I used to. I don't like the world. I can't stand this. I need relief. I need release, and I can't drink because my dad said this is where it happens. And so I sat in a 5.5 years stone. Don't try it. It's not useful. It's not useful. It doesn't take you to that place of ease and comfort that real Alcoholics Anonymous gives you. And so 5.5 years, that's what I did. That's where I met Chuck Chamberlain. And Chuck used to sit me down, and he would say this. He said, Mildred, he said, it looks as if your problem is drinking. But he said, your real problem is what everybody's real problem is. He said, there is only one problem. And that is this. It's a feeling of conscious separation from God. And he said, all problems stem from that. A feeling of conscious separation from God. And at the time, I didn't understand it. I get it completely today. It's taken a lot of pain. It's taken a lot of surrender. It's taken a lot of change, but I get it today. So, finally, I left AA. You can stand it so long. It wasn't you, and it was, I had a sponsor. He died last June. 62 years sober, sees Cargill. Some of you, if you were around, you would know of him. Fabulous. He was the big book in action. He didn't talk the big book, he lived it. And he was the one who took me to the jails and who took me to all over, even though he knew that I was always stoned. But he'd say, come on, and he knew that, you know, better that than me sitting at home feeling sorry for myself. Yeah, June the 2nd this year had been gone 1 year. And, I drank again. I thought I would be okay. I haven't had a drink for 5 years. It's not the way it goes. This is progressive and it's deadly. And I left thinking, well, I'll just take, you know, whatever I'm taking. That's not the way it went. I was gone 24 hours and I was into the booze. And within 48 hours, I had broken my 2 feet. I had jumped out of a 2-story window, and that story goes on, and I'll leave it at that. I drank for another year and a half, and that man I had married, he too was an alcoholic, and he too drank. And so we lost everything. And when I say lost everything, it had never occurred to me that this kind of thing could happen. I was a child in the way I lived and what I expected. I just thought, I don't know how I thought this was going to go. He wasn't working, I wasn't working, we were drunk all the time. And you can imagine the kind of decisions we made. And we lost everything. And so the last 3 weeks that I drank, I was on a park bench. Homeless, penniless, helpless. And the morning of May the 18th, tomorrow morning, 41 years ago, I woke up in the psych ward. And that didn't surprise me, but I couldn't move for a day or two. And on Sunday, it was a Sunday morning, the 20th, that I was in the washroom with the nurse, and I saw myself, teeth knocked out, hair scraggly. I weighed 85 pounds. And, you know, I had a big swollen eye and a big mark on my face. And I said to the nurse, I've become a woman of the streets, haven't I? You have to understand, that's coming from an ex-nun. They don't teach you how to be a person of the streets. I come from a decent family. My family didn't teach me also how to be a woman of the streets. And she said, yes, what are you going to do about it? And that's what stuck with me. What am I going to do about it? She took me to breakfast back to my room, and I thought, what am I going to do about it? And I knew what I was going to do about it. For the first time, it was no big deal to concede to you or to a psychiatrist or to a priest or a bishop or whoever wanted to hear it. I could concede to them that I was alcoholic. So what? If you felt like I do, you drink too. That was my sullen attitude. But to concede it to my innermost self, that was a different thing altogether. And that morning, it was more than conceding that I was alcoholic. It was conceding to my innermost self that I was done with life, that I didn't have a clue. Prayer comes in many forms. My prayers to God usually were my fists. This is what I want. This is how you better fix it. I'm in pain. Let me be sober. That didn't work. But this prayer worked. It didn't sound like a prayer to me. I'm going to take my life, half an hour, and I'm going to be done with this. Finally, I can't stand it anymore. That was my attitude. And so the nurse went to get, I didn't tell her, I just said, I want my clothes, I'm out of here. She went to get my clothes, and as she had gone to get my clothes, it was an instantaneous thing. It was as if a hand reached into me and took the compulsion and the obsession. That's the only way. It did not leave me. One minute I had it, and the next minute I didn't have it. And I remember standing in that room thinking, I don't know what has happened. I don't know who you are, but I don't have to drink anymore. And I was absolutely stunned. I knew that something profound had changed in me. And I remember saying out loud, I don't know how to live sober. I could never stay sober. I could always get sober, but never stay sober. And I remember saying, you'll have to send somebody. And there was an immediate rap on the door, and a man stood there. And he said, I saw you. I came to offer you some help. There's a hospital treatment center. 1973, there were no treatment centers around Toronto. I don't imagine there were many around here either. And a new day was coming. Whether it's good or bad, I'm not going to comment. But he took me the next day. He said, if you'll go tomorrow, I'll come and get you. Do you realize how many good people there are on the planet? There are lots of people who kill and murder and rape and make war, but there are also lots of good people who, out of the goodness of their heart, come to somebody like me. He said, I'm not an alcoholic, but I'll take you. And he did. And they took me in for 4 weeks. And at the end of the time, they hadn't pushed AA and they hadn't pushed God. Suited me fine. Hated both. And they gave me enough money that I could get a room on Skid Row. I had never seen Skid Row. I knew there were places like that. I had read about descriptions of them. I did not know what they were, and I was to find out because I lived there for a year. There was a psychiatrist at the hospital, and he said, you need a job. You're going to starve otherwise. I didn't know about welfare and that kind of stuff. Thank goodness. Tough 1 year. I lived on Skid Row. I lived, in a sense, without hope. I haven't got time to describe that, but it was an interesting period. And there was an angel at the hospital. He was a psychiatrist. He said, come and see me every week, and I did. He was my only hope. He said, you have to get a job. I went from door to door, and finally a man gave me a job sweeping the floor in the factory. And that's what I did my first year of sobriety, and lived on Skid Row. At the end of that, 6 months into that, I was in the institution, and somebody said, you want to come to a meeting, a man. where do you want to go? Let's go. And we went to a meeting of AA. I don't remember it, except I saw nice people. That's what I remember. People who smiled. People who seemed to like each other. I hadn't been aware of that in a long time, and I was attracted to it. Like, I'm sure a newcomer has got to have been attracted so far to what they've experienced here tonight. You've got to be a stone if your heart isn't moved by the feeling that's in this room, the feeling that was downstairs, the joyfulness and the welcome. And I fell in love with AA. My first sponsor got drunk. And two men at the group took me on. And they said, you're too sick to stay here. If you don't do the steps, you won't be able to stay. I said, I don't know how to do steps. I can't even read. I'm that broken. And so they said, you come early, and we'll read the book to you, and we'll tell you what to do. And that's how I did my first round of steps. Maybe not perfect. I think sometimes today we get into so much technical stuff and analyzing every word and mechanical stuff, and I did it, and I got it right, and there's no heart to it. I did what I was told, and there is such value in that. And in that process, I saw something which I have not lost in 40 years. And that was, I saw that I was the problem. I didn't know that. Psychiatrists helped me to see what was wrong with you and why your being had affected me. And that was not helpful to me. I was skilled at analyzing what's wrong with you. It doesn't matter. That's your stuff. I'm not taking your stuff on. That was a gift. And then I stayed in AA and became really, I've never left AA. I've done lots of stupid things sober. But the one smart thing I've really done, and that's I've stayed here, and I have hung in on the good days and the bad days. I've hung in on the days when I felt it was working, the days that I felt it wasn't. I want to talk to you about my experience in AA. I got a sponsor. He was tough, and I got him because he was tough. I'm stubborn and I'm full of myself. And he said that. You're the stubbornest person I've ever met. And so, but he said, if you do what I'm asking you to do, I'm going to take you through the steps again. And he said, I'll show you. That's what he did. He showed me some things about how to live by principle. And that was a great experience. He wouldn't let me buy pretty clothes. I got a teaching job the end of my first year of sobriety. And that was going into a world of so-called regular folks. They didn't care that I was alcoholic. They didn't want to hear about it. They just wanted me to come to school and do my job. And I had to learn where the steps fit in. How do you practice these steps in all your affairs and so on? And that's where that sponsor really helped me. At the end of that time, by a real gotcha, I had paid off my debts, separated from my husband, and we were divorced by this time. And there were several men traipsing through my life, including an alcoholic who couldn't stay sober. And I thought, well, I know how to stay sober. You'll learn. I found myself after 2.5 years, him lying on my bed, me with his ears in my hands, and I'm pounding his head on the bed. He's saying, get me some beer. How stupid can you get? You pray. He said, I don't want to pray. Well, I've got his ears in my hands. I come and I said, pray, son of a bitch. There's an end to that story. There is an end to that story. We finally separated. And he got sober. I thought he was going to kill himself without me. Instead, he got sober and died a couple of years ago. 16 years sober, beautifully sober, without me. There's a message. There's a message. So life went on, and I was sober 7 years, and I hadn't saved any money because my sponsor made me pay off the debts. I said, I don't want to give them my money, and he said, they don't want your money. They want their money with interest. Nasty business, isn't it? So at the end of that time, a friend came to me. You account for these God shots. I don't care. You know, you can say this is coincidence. A friend called me and said, my husband and I want to talk to you. You need to buy a house. This was a time in Toronto when everything was right for this. And I said, I don't have any money. And she said, we'll show you how it's done. And within 12 days, I bought my first house. I was to buy many houses. I want to talk about that first 20 years of sobriety. Because from 7 to about 20, I was very busy buying and selling houses. I was very busy in my career. I was getting promotions. And, you know, if you looked at me, I was busy in AA. I was going to meetings. I was speaking at meetings. I had sponsees. I was talking to my sponsor. I had it all going, baby. The only thing I didn't have going so well was my relationship with God. When you come in, that's why I started with the stuff I learned as a child. Sometimes you learn stuff as a child, that's been my experience, that you don't even know. See, I think we live our lives forward, but we understand them backward. As you go back, you see this. I can see now why I didn't pray much. You know, people talked about praying. Yeah. I didn't really listen. Because I learned as a child, you tell God, and it's kind of irrelevant. You want it fixed, go fix it yourself as best you can. Now, that's not what we learn here. But I heard what I heard. You know what Mark Twain said one time? He said, when the mind is not properly focused, the eyes don't see what's really there. My mind was focused on me. My mind was focused on, I'm a good member of AA. I'm doing service. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. And, you know, it's about not drinking. I don't believe that anymore. When Bill said in step 4, where he says, drink alcohol is the symptom of the problem, I believe that. Because what I found out was not drinking has not much effect on alcoholism. It has a lot of effect on the things that happen because you drink alcohol. You clean up, you brush your teeth, you put on clean clothes, you come to job, that kind of stuff. It affects that kind of thing. But what's going on here, that starts to be something different, where we begin to realize there's something bigger than me at work. And it came to me because I started to realize I don't feel okay. I'm horsing around with all kinds of men. I'm making all kinds of money. I bought all these houses. You know, I had my own house built. And it wasn't that I said, well, aren't I wonderful? That wasn't it. This is when something in me didn't feel good. And in 18 years, you see, I think sometimes we get sober and we clean up. We brush our teeth, we take a bath, we wash our hair, we put on clean clothes, we get a J-O-B, we get a girlfriend, boyfriend, we get laid, and we say, wow, this is recovery. I'm good to go. And I think that's the external stuff. And at some point, we get our real stuff handed to us. And mine got handed to me at about 18 years sober, where I'm sitting in my fine house, and it's not okay. It's not okay. I don't feel okay inside. I recognize, you know, I can come here and schmooze with the best of them. I don't feel okay inside. And so on and so on. And my sponsor took me through the steps again. And every time I've gone through the steps, I've been changed. Notice, I didn't say I'm changed. I've been changed by the process. And again, I started to, I knew something was on the way. 20 years, I separated from another man. I left my job. I knew it was time. I didn't want to, but I knew it was time. And I hadn't really prepared for retirement. And I went into a real serious depression. And, you know, I think this is just all so necessary. It's the stripping of the ego. It's the finding out that it doesn't work the way I thought it would. I thought if I could have money, and if I could have a big house, and if I could, you know, all of the stuff that I had, and it didn't mean a damn. And at 21 years, I thought, I think it's suicide time again. See, people sometimes say to me, you shouldn't say that. Why not? It's my experience. And it is through that that I got to the next surrender. And I got there. I won't take the time to go through that, but the day came where I absolutely knew it was okay. That I couldn't fix it, but that God could and would. And I got out of bed and I moved forward. My sponsor said, get up in the morning and act as if you've got a job to go to and so on. And one day the phone rang. It's amazing how sponsors are so wise, isn't it, Shannon? And the phone rang and it was Father O'Brien. This is really the important part of what I'm talking about. The rest prepared me for this. And it was Father O'Brien, a Jesuit from the Manresa Retreat House, and he said, I want you to come and give a retreat. And I said, Father, I couldn't do that. You don't know me. I said, you have no idea how many times I've been excommunicated. And he said, I don't care about that. He said, I want you to come. The thing I want to say to you is this. What I didn't know, and I learned that day, was this. I can have a problem, and the solution is being worked out in the background. I don't know that, but when I'm ready, the solution appears. See, I'm sitting there saying, I don't know what I'm going to do in retirement, etc. The solution was being prepared. When I said that to Father O'Brien, he said, Mildred, people have been talking to me about you, and they say I should bring you in to be a retreat director. I didn't have any training in that field. I had lots of theology and all that stuff. But he said, I want you to come. What I'm saying is that the plan was in place. I wasn't seeing it in place. And if you're sitting there today and you have no job and you don't have enough money or you've got relationship problems, if you can wait, if you can believe and trust that this plan is being worked out, the plan that you need, just like, did I know I should be giving retreats? No, I didn't. So I said, okay, and I went. And I gave a retreat to 75 women. I don't like women much. And at the end of the retreat, I'm standing in front of these women. Please, I love you women today. Properly. And I start bawling. I know how to shed a strategic tear in front of a man. I don't bawl in front of women. And that day I just bawled and I said, I don't have a friend in the world. I was as defenseless as I could be. And I said, I don't have a friend in the world. I've got lots of acquaintances, but I'm close to nobody. I really don't have the capacity to care for anybody, and I don't think anybody cares for me. That wasn't the truth, but that was the shedding of my walls. I couldn't have done that. We can't take process. The ego is invested in keeping our walls up. Because if my walls stay up, I'm going to behave, if the ego has control of me. And so if I try to take down my walls, I'm not going to do it properly. God doesn't. It's one of those times where in the book we see those words, suddenly, at once, things happen like that. God doesn't need time. When I'm ready, bingo, it happens. The walls were gone, and I had no feathers, and I'm like a chicken out in the cold. It was the best thing. I started to become real, and I started to be able to deal with people in a different way. People used to say to me, you know, you intimidate me. I thought it was a compliment for God's sake. So, you know, that kind of is the story of the next 10 years, that growth process. And that growth process was facilitated through silence, through prayer and meditation, meditation particularly. See, as Teilhard de Chardin said, once you start to believe that God is within, and I do believe that, then who am I going to pray to? I don't any longer believe there's God up there watching me. Deep in within, every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It is only there that he may be found. That started to motivate me. And I started to look at people different. Because if that power is within me, it's within you too. Whether I like you or not. I may not like the way you show up in the third dimension. But Bill is talking about the fourth dimension. He says, we've been rocketed into the fourth dimension. Are you sober today by the power of man? Or are you sober by the grace of God? By the strength of God in you, if at that point where you could say, I can't do this. I don't know how to do this. God always knows how. And if I stop saying, it's got to go this way, that's what our step three is about. Step one says, I have no power of my own. It doesn't say I've got some power. I have none of my own, or else throw the book away. Because it says, remember, we deal with alcohol. It's not the alcohol that's cunning, baffling, and powerful. It's how I deal with it. And then it says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. It doesn't say, well, there's this God, and he's got some power, and you've got the rest. That would be a hell of a world. And I think that's why we've got some of the confusion. And you see, it also then says life is unmanageable. God never gave me the title of manager. I am not to manage my life. I'm to suit up and show up and present myself in the third dimension with fourth dimension principles. That's the deal. And if I'll do that, I'll see a whole new way of existence. That, to me, is what the spiritual life is really about. See, as this process has gone on, I have been changed a great deal. I'm not perfect. I'm not aiming to be a saint. I'm just aiming to do a little better every day than I did yesterday. I want to talk to you just a little bit about what life is like today, because that is really the cycle of this whole process. Step one has become really crucial to me. Because the longer I'm around, I see this is a lot more than being powerless over alcohol. It's through that that I have learned I am powerless, period. I don't have power to make things the way I want. Hell, if I could have made things the way I want, I wouldn't be up here. I would never have had to concede to my innermost self. And that's one of the most important things I have learned. I cannot make the world the way I want. But I have, that's where it gets tricky. And that's where spirituality comes in. That's where our three legacies come in. That's where this whole deal really starts to take off. I learned in step one, through the alcohol drinking, that I'm powerless. By myself, I can't stop. And then the power does for me what I can't do, and I come to believe. I come to believe. Nobody lays on, you got to believe this, that, and the other. That's believing what somebody else says. There isn't a person in this room, I believe, who hasn't had the experience of God's grace active in their life. You see? And if we start to see that, then we start coming to believe. If you came in here with a shotgun today and said, Mildred, that thing did not happen to you on May the 20th, 1973. Take it back or I'll shoot you. There aren't many things I would respond to, but that one I would respond to like this. That really did happen, and shoot me then. I'm willing to go based on that, because that really has been my experience. See, there are things, I think that's one of the important things. And, you know, I think Carl Jung said it this way. He said he always believed that alcoholics were chasing the spirit, with a capital S, in every bottle of spirits. See, when you chase the stuff in the third dimension is always going to leave you restless, irritable, and discontent. You need a house, you get a house. And then a few years later, you got to have a bigger house. You get a car, you need the same car as your neighbors. Somebody told me yesterday, he lives in a neighborhood where people compare to have the best dog. But he said it. See, another mistake I made was I tried to fix my life from the outside in. If I could get the money, and I could get this, and I could get that, then I'd be okay, and everything has let me down. There is one thing that has never let me down, and that is the relationship with God. And on page 164, it says it, see to it that your relationship with Him is right, and then great things will come to pass for you and countless others. I guess the last thing I'll talk about is I've become really aware of something else in the last year. And I think everybody experiences it. I'm getting older and young in spirit. But as I get older, there's hardly anybody left in AA that was here. I see you shaking your head, sir. That was here when I came in. Seven of my brothers and sisters are dead. My nieces, their spouses are gone. I have 35 nieces and nephews, so that's great. I spend a lot of time, and that's why I won't be here July 5th, because I'm going to Saskatchewan for one of my nieces' 50th wedding anniversary. Shannon almost fainted when I said she was married 50 years. He said, 5-0? It may happen to you too, Shannon. Who knows? But what I really am talking about is this idea. You have no guarantee for tomorrow. The impermanence of our life experience. The one thing I can count on is the presence of God. What else are you sure of? See? We had a woman speak at our meeting on Thursday night. She's sober 3 or 4 years, I think, just come through a bout with cancer. And she talked about the fact that she realized that some days she thinks about the impermanence of her cure. And she looks in the mirror to see, is the cancer coming back? And then she said she has to know what I'm talking about. You have no guarantee that you'll be here tomorrow. I have no guarantee. I really, do you get that? I think it's part of, if you have no belief in a power bigger than yourself, I think life has to just be a very scary business. If you have no relationship with that power, no belief that life goes on and that we put down, you know, I go to the cemetery sometimes and I go and walk past the graves of some of the people whose bodies I related to. I don't know where their spirits are. But that whole thing that I think of, maybe to make this in concrete terms, this thing that I'm talking about, this impermanence. It isn't life that's impermanent, it's the experience of life. See, when I was a little girl, we didn't get a whole lot of new clothes. Even though my father had money, we weren't into shopping. And I did get, when I was about 8 years old, a new pair of brown loafers. But they weren't just loafers. They were loafers covered in magic. And I'd look at those loafers, and I'd look down, and all I saw was magic, and life was good, and nothing could hurt me. It was just wonderful. I'd put them under the bed at night, and I'd lift the blankets, and I'd look under the bed. There was the magic. And I'd go, close my eyes and go to sleep again because everything was good. And I don't know how many days went by. And one day somebody came and took the magic away. And I looked and they were just loafers. See, I don't think that's really the total picture. I think we look at our lives and when we strip, when some of the magic of that third dimension, I'm so happy I'm going to a concert. I'm so happy I have a new car. I'm so happy I've got this. I'm so happy this is happening. And when that gets stripped, that's when we find the real magic that doesn't go away. And that is all contained in that beautiful statement, see to it, that your relationship with Him is right. And then great things will come to pass for you and countless others. Great peace of mind, great joy, great happiness. God bless you all. Thank you.
Close this meeting with a reading from page 164 of the Big Book, followed by a moment of silence and serenity prayer, and Mary's going to come up and do that for us now.
Hi, I'm Mary. I'm an alcoholic. So grateful to be here tonight. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the Spirit, the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. That's it. Let's have a moment of silence and then we'll close with this surrendering prayer.
Thank you.